So welcome back, everyone, for our third and final class on the topic of man's place in the universe.
That's this mini series,
and then we're going to move on from there. I know we've covered the entire topic.
Man's place in the universe.
Yeah. I know, maybe if we give it one more topic, we could kind of
nail it down. Right, really figure it all out.
But I really just want to take the opportunity to open up the topic and to share some perspectives. And today, what I'd like to do, both for those who are here previously and those who are joining as well, is sort of to take it one step further. And essentially, just by way of very brief summary, we've basically seen that there's really a problem or a set of challenges that that modern findings or the modern temperament and certain scientific findings as well have posed to the classical religious notion that the human being in one way or another is the center of the universe. And we saw that enunciated both in the Western canon generally, in the Jewish tradition in particular. And really the question becomes, in light of modern science, in light of our knowledge that the Earth is not the center of the universe, and that man is not the center of the Earth, and that our galaxy is not the central galaxy of the universe, and we're just some little corner in the outer reaches of the Milky Way. So in light of some of these scientific findings and also Darwin and evolution and some of these ideas, so the question as to was everything created for humanity, or are we really more in a spectrum of animal kingdom and human beings, and sort of where do we fit in, and how do we grapple with that from a Jewish perspective? We've got a lot of different sources, and one of the things that I'd like to do in order to forward the conversations, we started to look at the thought of Rav Soloveitchik. And Rav Soloveitchik really made the argument that if you go back to the beginnings of our tradition, really there's this notion of this dichotomy, where we are both part of the natural world and yet somehow apart from. And that sort of struggle, that tension, really lies at the very core of our being. We saw last week a short piece in which the Rav described a particularly poignant passage about his emotional state in context of a difficult time with his wife, who was very ill at the time. But he really took that as an opportunity to begin to develop this idea that there are two quote-unquote men, or two types of human being. And there he called it the majestic man on the one hand, and then he called it the origin-minded man on the other. Where the origin-minded man is the one who recognizes that, hey, dust. That's it. That's where I come from. That's really all I am. So that was really sort of the first stab of Rav Soloveitchik, the first sort of place that we saw where he began to develop this dichotomy. I'd like to look at is two more examples from Thor the Rav. One I have in front of you, and one is not here, but I'd like to review. So the second thing I gave you, and if you take a look, it's a few pages into the source sheet. It's the fifth side overall, and this is an article from Rav Soloveitchik. It's actually not written directly by him. This is a summary, a compiled summary of two of his lectures. I believe the title of the book you can see here is Rabbi Soloveitchik on the Days of Awe. I believe it's compiled by a gentleman, I think, lives in Edison, New Jersey, by the name of Arnie Lustiger. And he's compiled some things in the Rav. I think the Rav knew that he was going to publish this material, but I don't know that the Rav sort of went over it. And yet, I think it really, in a powerful way, speaks to some of this dichotomy, and also in a way that's really very relevant to this coming week in particular, and that's this article on the Slichot. And essentially, take a look. We'll read just some snippets here from the beginning, and then we'll jump in and out. So he opens, "Judaism has always thought of man antithetically, based on two mutually exclusive principles. One concept is that man is an important, powerful, and exalted being, capable of reaching dizzying intellectual and spiritual heights. Man embodies a divine element that allows him proximity to his creator. On the other hand, Judaism also perceives man as a worthless, lowly being. Not only is he weak and helpless, but he's capable of becoming morally corrupt, cruel, beastly, defiling both himself and the world. Reflecting this dual perception of man, Chazal the rabbi said, if man is meritorious, he is told, you have preceded the angels. And if not, he is told, a mosquito has preceded you. which we'd seen back in the first week. And the Rav goes on to suggest that this dichotomy, that this sort of tension within humanity is actually manifest, in the Rav's opinion, in the distinction between two modes of prayer. And Tzvi says, and it's interesting, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this as well. What the Rav suggests, if you read forward, is he starts with the Amida, and he starts with the Shmona Esrei. So what's our posture when we daven the Shmona Esrei?
Okay.
So he's going to suggest, although, so this is what's interesting, hold that thought.
Both.
Right? So that's what I would have said. And I want to hold that thought, because that's what I'm suggesting. But here's what the Rav actually suggests here, that the primary mode or primary posture during tefillah is
upright.
Right, is upright. And then there are exceptions, but I guess for the purpose of this drasha, he didn't stress that particular, the other aspects of it. And he said the Amidah is basically built on the thesis, on the notion that man is a dignified being who can stand upright and engage in a dialogue with the Almighty. That's a shocking thesis. Many religions, many faiths would never conceive of such a notion, but Judaism did, and Judaism does. And that's really the central thrust of the Amidah. The Gemara talks about the notion of being just a little bit dressed up, spruced up, a little bit more nicely for tefillah. And the Rav uses that also as an example of this idea. So for the Rav, in this presentation at least, the Amidah, the regular Shmona Esrei, speaks to the dignity of man, to majestic man, to our ability to stand and engage in dialogue with our Maker, which is a pretty remarkable kind of thing. And then the Rav says that there's another mode of prayer, which we don't always think of as the traditional type of prayer or the same framework, but in a sense, it's sort of the counterpart to the Amidah. And here he identifies that as the Slichot. And essentially what the Rav suggests is that the Slicha represents that other half of the dichotomy. If you take a look at the bottom paragraph on 44. On the other hand, there's a different set of prayers that is based on the opposite assumption, the nihility of man. The prayers of Slichot are predicated on man's worthlessness and weakness, his loneliness and helplessness, of his base nature that allows him to become corrupt and defiled. The piyutim of Slichot are infused with this one idea. How can lowly man possibly approach God? How can man address himself to him? In spite of all his progressive ideas, all his technological discoveries, man is defiled, corrupt, ignorant, a prisoner of nature. The greatness of man is the lodestar of prayer the whole year, while the weakness and helplessness of man is the guiding motif of the Slicha. And he goes on to also invoke Netana Tokef. Netana Tokef, if I would ask you, in the prayer of Netana Tokef, is the stress on the greatness of man or on the smallness of man? What would you say?
It's God is awesome and man is...
Okay, right, man is small, right? And he quotes actually toward the very end of Netana Tokef. Man is likened to a broken shard, a fading flower, passing shade, dissipating cloud, a blowing wind, flying dust, and a fleeting dream. Not much to write home about. It's interesting to me that in Netana Tokef, because this, to me, as someone living in the Western world in the 21st century, if you would ask me to go out and take an imaginary poll, and say, which of these two modes of relating to God resonates most with you? And I would just go out to the streets. What would you expect? What do you think we would get? What do you think? I'd be curious. Which mode do you think people relate to? Both. Difference between how young and a person is. I don't know. That's interesting.
I think when you're young, you're right there.
We'll do a couple of different polls. I don't know. I think probably the answer is both. I think if you would, let's say, compare it to the Jewish experience or the Ashkenazic experience, for the sake of comparison, in Eastern Europe in the 19th century, and you do the same poll there, how do you think it would match up?
Nineteenth century,
Eastern Europe.
Lowly.
Lowly because of the surroundings, how the rest of the world perceives you.
Is this the Enlightenment? I mean, is this like
Muslim movement?
Right. Although we talked about the Muslim movement, also itself was split. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the poll would have. I'm not going to venture a guess about the poll. It's going to be hard to reproduce. I have to go back and do that. But at least to me, America, for example, is just a lot happier society than, you know, I don't know, Minsk, mid-19th century or turn of the 20th century Minsk. It just maybe it was the weather. It was pretty cold and miserable there. I don't know. To me, there's something about the sort of the more aspirational, positive aspect that speaks a little bit more to our culture. There's no right answer, but at least relative to some of our prior experiences, to me that there seems to be a certain truth to that. So to me, in light of that, it's maybe interesting. I don't know. I'm just food for thought that Unetana Tokef nevertheless somehow captures the spirit of so many of us. I just think it's really interesting that maybe it's because it's countercultural, maybe it's because it harkens back to something deep within us, certain maybe healthy but sort of primal fears that resonate on a deep level but we don't necessarily express on as regular basis in our wider society. I don't know.
I'm asking, rather than the degree to which there have been attempts at making us, the Jews in particular, so lowly that we resist that. Oh no.
So then why doesn't it, but Unetana Tokef, then why does it resonate?
I think it doesn't, I'm suggesting, because there seems to be... some of the distance might be because too many people from a very negative point of view, from a destructive point of view, tried to convince us, not particularly that mankind is lowly, but the Jews in particular are so lowly. So that it may be that some of us might resist some of that.
Interesting.
From a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could see where I'm coming from.
Right.
But the other thing I wanted to say is that now that we're discovering, science is discovering how complicated the animal world is, even the insects, I think that's another direction from which making us feel humble is coming. You know, we thought we're so great and so on, and look at this little bacteria.
So you're saying that animals are at a footing of...
No, I'm not saying that we're on that footing, but
close to it, or getting closer?
It gives pause to the notion that... I still think that human consciousness, spirituality, all that distinguishes us by kind, not by degree. But I think it does give... It gives me pause to think how complicated even the little tiniest creatures are.
Well, I think it's a matter of identification, and throughout the ages, Jews were able to endure what they were endured, not because they didn't identify with the animal world and their basic needs that we perceive animals as doing, even though recent studies make, but we had a history and we had which elevated us, and our forefathers recently identified with kings and their struggles for right and wrong and to fulfill God's commandments. So regardless of their physical station in life socioeconomically, they were on a different plane.
That is interesting also. Thank you. Okay, so this is sort of the dichotomy of the Rav here. What's interesting also is that he adds that there's another aspect of tefillah that in his conceptualization, again, in this particular presentation, fits into the slichot mode more than in the traditional davening mode, which is mariv. The Rav here says something very interesting. We know that the Gemara talks about whether or not mariv, evening prayer, is obligatory, right? Whether it's tefillah arvit is chovah or rishut. Why would it not be mandatory the same way as the other tefillo? So the Rav suggests here, which is very interesting, his sort of stab at it, explanation here, is that essentially, if prayer in its most pristine, in its sort of its ultimate state, the Platonic prayer is man standing upright proudly before God in his presence and engaging in conversation, then Maariv, which is at night, which is a time in which there's a sense of anxiety about ourselves, especially before electricity in particular, but I think even now it still carries with us to a lesser degree, but it still does, that notion that we don't have the same sense of security and don't have as assured footing at nighttime. And so therefore the Rav suggests night is not fully compatible with the fullest sense of tefillah, because we're not really able at night to stand upright in that same kind of way and to daven to God and to speak to him out of that same sense of confidence and from a place of strength as we can during the daytime. We still can daven, but it's somehow lacking something. There's something missing. And so therefore suggests the Rav, Maariv is Rishus, because Maariv is really a mode that's more consistent with Slichot. Indeed, the Slichot, ideally, are performed during the nighttime. The first Slichot, we have the practice still to do it at night. Some actually do get up that early, but that was really the original practice, was to get up either in the middle of the night or before dawn, because really the Rav suggests that was a sense of the smallness of man, and that's felt most keenly and most acutely during the evening. And so Maariv is sort of akin, the nighttime prayer really begins to approximate the Slichot. So that's sort of the Rav's distinction. It's a very beautiful one, and I think it goes to, again, it's one example, one expression of this overall dichotomy, which really runs like a thread throughout the Rav's thought. It's not just a leitmotif, it's not just sort of secondary, it's really a central theme around which his entire thought revolves. Now, that being said, I think that's what he said in this drasha, but I think we could start to explore this a little bit more fully with regard to tefillah, for example. So Scott says, well, we stand for the majority of tefillah, but
we subjugate ourselves in some way. Also, I don't know who this attributed to, but there's this notion that when one is davening upright, you should have this feeling of falling, like you're like being just suspended, in effect, like in some sense.
I think it's a Hasidic.
So it's not that you're upright or some kind of haughtiness. Even if you're upright, uh-huh, it's this like hanging in the balance kind of
thing. Fascinating. That's interesting. There is a halakha that that if one is leaning, that might not constitute standing in halakha, and therefore one might not fulfill the obligation. So at first glance, I would have said that speaks to the Rav's idea that one really has to be upright. Uh-huh. But with this twist, they would take it right from the other direction, is that the only entity that can be suspending us is God himself and not something here that's man-made. That's really interesting as well.
But I thought that also in the Shemoneh Esrei, and in certain parts of the community, to feel like on Yom Kippur, you're supposed to be like angels. I mean, I think that there's an aspect of the way your stance for the is supposed to be, you know, like an angel. So that is clearly an opposite to the more lowly,
That's interesting. And that you could suggest then that the rest of the year maybe would be different. Is that the suggestion, or you're saying that
when you say the paradigm of Shemoneh Esrei is that
it's angelic.
Yeah.
Since Kedusha, it's all of that, 100%. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik actually had the practice that he would stand with his feet together for large swaths of the Yamim Noraim Tefillot, which can get uncomfortable after a while. some people have that experience kind of past. But his thinking was exactly this, that really there's that angelic posture, which at least Yom Kippur and the Yom Kippur really are meant to manifest. So that's along those lines. It's interesting also, and I think there's a lot more to say about tefillah. I'll add two thoughts. Number one about tefillah and the other one about the slichot, to turn back to that side of the dichotomy and question there a little bit as well. With regard to the tefillah piece, so there's a fascinating Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, and the Gemara inquires as to the proper positioning of the shofar. And the Gemara has two opinions. There's one opinion that maintains that the shofar needs to be held upright, which is our contemporary practice, and the alternative view is that the shofar actually has to be face down.
Can we do that these days?
What? No, we don't paskin that way. Some suggest because it wouldn't resonate as effectively. Also, just there's something about the image. It's just, something might be lost. But then the Gemara actually has those two opinions. And then the Gemara further suggests that the posture of the shofar is reflective of a wider debate as to the proper posture of one who prays. Whether one should be right, upright, or the hunchback. And the Gemara actually suggests that that's actually the basis for the debate. This goes to a separate conversation, which is the linkage between shofar and tefillah. The notion that shofar is a mode of prayer, that shofar is an instrument or a special tool that we utilize specifically on Rosh Hashanah in order to entreat God and to bring our prayers to Him before Him. But it's fascinating, again, that this question is the essence of tefillah, and we're sort of identifying this tension within tefillah. The Rav is obviously focusing on one side, but we're suggesting there might be another mode of tefillah or aspect of tefillah or way of thinking about tefillah that I think the Gemara really opens up the question in a way that's relevant not only to the slichot, but also to the shofar itself. On the shofar side of things, I would tend to think that the shofar probably, my tendency would be, at first glance, to say that the shofar represents the loneliness in the sense that just that it's drawn specifically from an animal horn, and the Gemara actually makes a big deal out of the fact that it's specifically coming from the animal, which is interesting in this whole conversation. And the Gemara actually, the Yerushalmi, that actually suggests in one place that we ask God to consider as if we are, this is the translation that's usually given, we're squealing like animals before you. That's one side of the shofar. But at the same time, right, there's also the notion that, right, there's a coronation, right? Now, it's true that he's the king, but hey, as we say in our tradition, ein melech below am, right? There's no such thing. Can't be a king without us, right? Don't forget the subjects, because there ain't no subjects to coronate the king, then guess what, right? There's no throne to sit upon. So there is a sense in which, at the same time, the shofar represents our ability to coronate God. And so you kind of wonder if this same dichotomy is actually manifest in the shofar itself, and there are different themes or approaches within the shofar, maybe even different aspects of the shofar over the course of Rosh Hashanah. It's fascinating that we don't blow the shofar once. We blow 100 voices overall, and it's 3 different sections in the prayer services, and it's just sort of in broad strokes. You have it first after we read from the Torah, even before we begin to daven Musaf, and that's the first 30 where we fulfill the biblical obligation of shofar. But then again, another 30 that in Ashkenazic custom, we blow typically another 30. Some parts of the Sephardic community, they actually blow 30 both in the silent Shemona Esrei and then another 30 in the repetition of the Shemona Esrei. So it's either 30 or 60 even during the Musaf, and then another 10 or 40 at the very end of the Tefillah. And so it's possible, kind of wonder, and it's been suggested that the different phases, you have to figure out which is which, but sort of the different motifs of the shofar, different modes in which they represent of us standing before God, if it's even possible that those actually are reflected in the different aspects or different moments when we blow the shofar, and then not every shofar blowing is exactly the same as the one before. Which it kind of explains why we do all that. It's a lot to, like, at a certain point, it's hard to, for me at least, I don't know if others have had this experience, but what do I feel and what do I think? And there's a lot of shofar blowing to really define, you know, to really have the proper kavana in each one. And if there can be different aspects, there's the coronation, there's the wake-up call for tshuva, there's the sense of prayer, and there are different aspects. There's sort of a messianic overtone to it, where we're anticipating, as we talk about in Musaf,
each
maybe at different times. That's what I'm suggesting. There's one way of thinking about it is, I'm suggesting that it's only because it can help us to sort of hone in on the different aspects of the shofar at the different times of the prayer, which I think, for me at least, is something that can be challenging. Which is, I'm going to do it twice and 100 times each. It's a lot. So something that works for me.
Also, it again combines our nature as we're taking something animal and mm-hmm. we're making it into mm-hmm. an instrument. We're doing something very special.
to the animal.
We're elevating somehow. Yeah, that
and
needs
that's
to be.
We take nature. Mm-hmm. We do something special with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I want to come back to that because that's going to be really important as we continue as well. So I'm glad you said that. So that's one place where the Rav begins to develop this dichotomy that was just so relevant for this time of year. I thought it was really appropriate. The second one, which I didn't give you here because it's worth a class and multiple classes in its own right. And I think we studied this a little bit in the morning class last year. The Rav develops a lot of this in The Lonely Man of Faith, which we won't go through now, but in depth or inside. But I think it's worthwhile, if we're familiar or unfamiliar with it, to review the Rav's basic development of ideas, because it's both essential in its own right, it's fascinating, and it speaks very much to a lot of these issues and a lot of the questions that we're raising. So just to give the brief overview. So first of all, fascinating is that The Lonely Man of Faith is really, in a sense, a more universal formulation of some of these ideas. It was actually originally delivered at a Catholic seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts in 1963, I think, which it's interesting that wasn't controversial. But I guess, right. So either times have changed, or if you're the Rav, you can get away with these things. I don't know. But be that as it may, the Rav is trying to develop a universal notion, but I think it's one that really is targeting our community, the modern community. Again, originally delivered 50 years ago, but I think for me at least, and for many, it resonates now. And essentially what the Rav argues is that the man of faith is lonely. And what he does is this essay is an attempt to unpack that statement. Why he is, he sort of starts with a personal confessional, and he says, I, as a man of faith, find myself to be lonely. He distinguishes lonely from aloneness. To be alone is a physical state of being. I can be alone if I am here in the Beit Midrash and no one shows up for the class and I feel alone. I may also feel lonely, but that's a different experience. Aloneness is a physical state of being. Loneliness is an internal state of being. It's an emotional experience. It's what the Rav would call an existential state of being, related to existence. Loneliness is a sense that I don't have deep relationships, deep connections to other people, to God, to whomever, whatever it may be, that I feel a sense of loneliness. I can be in a room, I'm sure we've all had this experience at various times, where I can be in a room with hundreds and hundreds of people. Some people feel like this at Kiddush every week. Alright? And I'm certainly not alone, but I'm feeling socially awkward right now, right? That's a common feeling that many people report. They feel not alone, but very lonely. And that's a common experience that many people undergo. The Rav says, I'm not talking about aloneness, I'm talking about something much more profound, much deeper, namely loneliness. Then goes ahead and he says, what does it mean to be a man of faith? So essentially he suggests that actually the religious persona is actually divided into two different categories. There's what the Rav calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. And these refer specifically to the first two chapters of Genesis, and the Rav outlines four apparent contradictions. We're not going to review all the details, but basically four different sort of characteristics or features of the creation of humanity that appear on the one hand as presented in the first parak of Bereshit, and on the other hand in the second parak. And in fact, the Rav says very openly that many biblical scholars have pointed to this and suggested multiple authorships and what's going on. So the Rav says that the observations of these biblical critics are correct, but how he nevertheless pushes back and says that their conclusion is wrong. It's not that there are multiple authors of these two sections of the Torah. Rather, there are two Adams. The reason that the two presentations, the two depictions of the creation of man are so different is because man himself exists in two very different worlds. There is Adam 1 and there's Adam 2, and that's exactly the difference between these two presentations of the creation of man. Man is created twice in the sense that there really are two fundamentally different creations or characteristics of man. Notice that one of them has man, for example, lording over nature, if you think about the first one. And the second one has man created from
dust.
Right, from a speck of dust. That's specifically, take a look back, in the second Perek of Bereishit. And so the Rav begins to develop this, these characteristics of Adam 1 on the one hand to Adam 2 on the other. Basically what the Rav tells us, what he teaches is that Adam 1 is a technological mankind, sort of Western man, modern man, who lords over his or her environment. Essentially, the Torah tells us, it teaches that human being, you should go into the among the fish of the sea, and so on and so forth. You should conquer the natural world. Kibush, you should lord over it. Adam 1 is technological man who inquires about what are sort of the scientific facts of the world around him and seeks through that knowledge to essentially control nature, to dictate it, to lord over his environment. Adam 1 is not particularly concerned with questions of why. These questions are the scientific questions. They're questions of how. How does everything work, and how can I understand the essence of things, the underlying mathematical and scientific principles, so that I can build the next iPad, or right, get to the moon, or whatever it may be. And that's Adam 1. Adam 2, he defines that interesting word, which is a really interesting conversation. He identifies that with the characteristic of dignity, which is interesting, and I wouldn't have necessarily expected that word, but the Rav here sees dignity as sort of man's ability vis-a-vis the world around him to basically engage with that sense of stature in an upstanding way, that I can dictate, that I can control, that I can take responsibility, that I can tinker, that I can change, that I can cure natural disease, that I can raise the life expectancy of the human being by decades through my scientific research and through medical advancement, and so on and so forth. All of those are the achievements in the character of Adam 1. Just one sec. And then he comes to Adam 2. He says that Adam 2 is quite the opposite. Adam 2 is not interested in a sort of a surface encounter with the world around him, but rather essentially sees through, after having lorded over nature, recognizes in nature its creator. And Adam, too, instead of being interested in lording over nature, quite the opposite, he recoils from nature because of what it represents, which is, of course, godliness. Adam, too, is not interested in a dignity in the sense of conquering, but quite the opposite. It's actually an act of recoil or defeat, where we say, in awe of God's majesty, of God's grandeur, I am infinitesimally small. This is exponentially greater than anything I could ever conceive of. I feel humbled and awed. I'm not interested anymore in the question of how does it work, but I'm asking probing, deep existential questions. Why? Why is this here? And what is my place in the universe? And how do I begin to measure up in sort of the context of this grandeur, this cosmic world that so humbles me. The Rav defines this as not dignity, but rather he calls it redemption. And by redemption, again, it's an interesting word, I wouldn't have necessarily expected here, but he calls it, in this context, he calls it a sense of redemptiveness, which means that it's not just a surface kind of relationship, but through that sense of awe, the majesty and grandeur of the world around me, I sort of humble myself. So that's sort of that's the distinction. Hold on one second. I just want to take it one more step further. And then had a point as well. He further argues that Adam 1 and Adam 2 also form qualitatively different kinds of communities. This is a really interesting aspect of this. Communities are relationships. So what kind of relationship would we expect from Adam 1 with the people around him or her, or with God, for that matter? What kind of relationship would we expect from Adam 1?
Intellectual.
Intellectual? Other words? Comes to you.
Well, didn't God give him the power to rule over the animals?
The animals. What about fellow human beings? I'm not talking about in a hierarchical relationship, even in an equal relationship.
I think he practice about him as well. This is the first one there.
Okay, maybe they're all lording over each other. Maybe it's an egotistical relationship. It's a self-centered
it's a
one.
Social. This is a more social.
Okay. What do you mean by social?
Well, I mean, I think that I thought that like the dignity had something to do with really being like it was you were digging. It's almost like you had like he. I remember. I don't know if it was in a different essay where he talks about like his own loss and how he had to kind of handle it with dignity. Like he wasn't about falling apart. Mm-hmm. It was about like being recognizing that you had a role to play almost and to be. I think Adam One is a more social person.
Interesting. Well, I would say that the social relationship, I mean, you can see maybe an extroverted piece, sort of the redemptive person is very introspective, and relative to that, I can see Adam One being more extroverted. What? Who are what?
Is it the other people? It's just Adam.
No, but I should have probably started this way, but these are typologies. I mean, these are not just readings of, Adam in the original sense, but these are the Rav, and there are no pure types like either one, Adam 1 or Adam 2, but these are metaphoric. These are ways of describing the nature of the very essence or essential nature character of the human being. So we are all Adam 1s and Adam 2s. We all have a mix. If you didn't know it before you came, that's okay. But you know what? That's what we learned. You learn something about yourself, at least. So what else? I would say, I would use words like utilitarian. What do I mean by that? Why is this relationship utilitarian for Adam 1? Why is it about the utility of what I get out of the relationship?
Give and take. I give you something, you give me.
Okay, there you go, right? It's a functional kind of relationship. So we have a certain goal that we want to accomplish. So what do? So I bring the technological know-how, and you bring certain scientific, right, perspective. And the third one is an engineer, and they bring that kind of understanding. And if we put it all together, so what are we going to do? Right? We're going to build a bridge that spans, I don't know, right? Or whatever it may be. Right? So it's a very sort of surface, functional, instrumental kind of relationship that Adam 1 tends to build. We just want to know how. We don't want to get to the essence of things in terms of some deeper, mysterious, sort of essential kind of level. We want to know sort of the essence of how it works, but that's really it. And so those are the kinds of relationships. Whereas Adam 2 was interested in very introspective, very deep, very probing, very reflective kind of, Elul, Yamin, Orayim kinds of questions. What is this all about, and why am I here, and what do I make of the majesty of the universe, and I can never begin to understand or conquer this. And at the very moment that I think that I can build communities that conquer death, all of a sudden I'm hit by the next earthquake or the next tsunami or whatever it may be, the next Ebola virus, right? Ultimately, there's only so much that we can do. And so that human being was asking these really probing, deeper kinds of questions. The relationships are much deeper. They're much more essential. They go to the core. When we have a relationship, we're somehow bonding. To borrow Martin Buber's language, it's not an I-it relationship, it's an I-thou relationship. There's a depth to the kind of community that Adam 2 builds that Adam 1 is not able to achieve. Now, Adam 2 may not accomplish as much in the, in the modern sense of the term of accomplishment or building, or, right, you're not expecting the next great discovery necessarily to come, right, out of when they were doing, when they were involved in the Manhattan Project, right? Adam 2 is who wouldn't have necessarily gotten the job done. Adam 1s have a place in this world, but it's just a very different mode. The Rav's not being judgmental, he's just being descriptive. And so that's sort of, those are some of the essential characteristics of these two. Any thoughts before we now take it a step further? Get us thought earlier, or we're good? Oh.
I mean, you can ask the age-old question, so what does it mean to be human? is humanity rooted in Adam 1 and Adam 2.
Right.
What you're saying is Adam 2, when we think of humanity and we think of all the great accomplishments, and, right, technological progress, prowess, we think of Adam 2.
Right.
Definitely. I think,
technological prowess is Adam 1.
Is Adam 1.
Oh, sorry, Adam 1.
Yeah.
But when we think about the deep emotional things of, you know, when we comfort somebody, when we pain ourselves, we say, that's as true or true to you. So, it has nothing to do with.
That's interesting. We say it ourselves in our own parlance. That is fascinating.
But we don't, and that usually is dissociated from how brilliant or how accomplished someone is.
We don't say that that's humane. The way that we use that term, humane. Fascinating.
Community of scientists, in the broader sense of the word, ink people who, so I want to say scientists and technologists, and Adam too is the philosopher, moralist, psychologist.
Right. I think, I don't know if the only concern is I could see the psychologist, you're getting yourself in some trouble here.
What? No, but I meant that the goal is to understand how do you what makes people.
You're saying the goal, not the nature of the discipline itself?
Yeah.
That's how you're trying to take your foot out of your mouth?
No, seriously. In the sense that the goal is to understand, well, why and under what circumstances do people feel suffering? And how can we alleviate suffering when you're feeling.
Were you saying about one?
No, that
Adam 2. She's asking certain disciplines are more aimed at trying to address or resolve the questions or the anxieties and the concerns of Adam 2. That's interesting.
But it also tracks human.
That's really interesting.
It also tracks, you know, child development, because children at earlier stages of adolescent and pre-adolescent are very utilitarian and functional, and then you hope, and very concrete, and then you hope that they evolve.
That's fascinating. So another way to sort of, I know that's very interesting. So another way to, that would be another way of framing the different stages of development. Until X point in Piaget or Erickson or whomever, you're Adam 1, and only Adam 2 only develops at a later stage. Empathy, and they talk about one hope. There are cases of arrested development.
There is, but that's an external process. I mean, that's a process that internalized. I mean, it's just nature is what allows you to be utilitarian. Mm-hmm. All children are utilitarian in their relationship with their parents, and then with input and nurture and environment and community and yada yada yada, they become Adam 2. One hopes.
Right. Or also Adam 2.
Right. They integrate Adam 2 into Adam
100%. Okay. Fantastic. That's really interesting.
I like great the dichotomy, the notion of how separate these two, approaches may be. I'm not so sure that they're so separate. I think that there's a lot of reciprocity. I'll summarize very quickly something I want to tell you. I just read an article by Jerome Bruckman, who is a physician who likes to explain medicine to regular folks. In short, there's a new approach, it was in last week's New Yorker, there's a new approach to a certain kind of leukemia, and the person who started it, suggested this approach, is Chinese. And he got his inspiration from Confucius. In other words, he applied something that he read in Confucius to medicine, i.e., apparently, cancer cells are all very immature, and then they go crazy and growing. And the goal for the existing strategies has been to destroy the cancer cells. So he was struck by something in Confucius that said, what do we do with an immature person?
we try to help him become mature. So somehow or other, I mean, this is what I guess genius is, he said, well, maybe we should try that with these immature cancer cells. Make them mature. And he uses these words and see if they start to behave well. I swear, I can put you in the article. And if they behave well, these mature cells start to behave like regular cells, great. If we, if they don't, then we destroy them. And somebody developed a medication that can help these cells mature. I'm just trying to bring up that from a philosophical, moral treatise, he made this leap to the world of science. I was blown away when I read this. So I'm just suggesting that I think that the relationship between Adam 1 and Adam 2 is more interactive. That's all.
Fascinating. We had a group of rabbis who had done those who know Rabbi J.J. Schachter,
sure.
It's your last year. So he does these training seminars with rabbis, and we had a group. We had different. It's a 2-year program, and we had a group of alumni from this program over the course of probably 8 to 10 years. And we went up to Boston for like 3 days, and had a whole program. So we spent one day at the Harvard Hillel, and we heard lectures from Ruth Weiss, who's the Yiddish scholar. She just retired. I think she's now living in New York. I believe so. And at least for the year, she's no longer. I think she was at Harvard. She's no longer there. I think she's retired now. And the other person we heard from was Jerome Gutman, this doctor. I had read some of his stuff. And it was what was fascinating to me is he's a very traditional Jew, and he just loves meeting this group of 40 rabbis. And he is loving it. These 40 modern Orthodox rabbis. It was just fascinating. And one of the things he said was that there are so many of his ideas that he wishes he had sort of a certain kind of audience who could then broadcast some of these things. Because like they're both celebrities. Like, what are they? It was Ruth Weiss and Jerome Koopman. These are like, they're writing in he writes in the New Yorker all the time. They've become books. I mean, the guy's, he's out there. The professors quote him in their courses, right? But they're both so excited to meet these rabbis. This is an opportunity to interact in that way. It was very interesting. It was very interesting. Fine. So this is the core of sort of the two atoms that the Rav develops. Now, then where he goes with this is he says, okay, so those are two aspects. So sort of that's the wholeness of sort of the man of faith. The true man of faith combines Adam 1 and Adam 2. And then he says that the man of faith is lonely, especially accenting Adam 2, the man of faith, the humane man, right? Or that sort of searching, overawed, why-oriented introspective human being feels lonely on two levels. Number one, feels lonely in essence, because it is no one. If we have a utilitarian relationship, that's all we seek to achieve, like Adam 1, so then we can get that. But to really connect with someone on that deep level in the way that Adam 2 truly aspires toward is not something that comes about every day. And it, those kinds of relationships are sometimes elusive. And so there's very often a loneliness that comes with the Adam 2. So that's sort of one piece of it. But then the Rav says, and it comes to sort of the thrust of his article, he said, the lonely man of faith is not only generally lonely or essentially lonely, but is particularly lonely in the modern era. He says, because in modern times, what we've become too much is a society of Adam 1s. It's sort of his diagnosis. I mean, it's obviously a generalization and a simplification. The Rav would be first to say, obviously, there are lots of exceptions at all levels. But bigadol, on the whole, we've created, says the Rav, in this really devastating critique of modern society, of Western civilization, basically, that we've created, is that there is too much of a value assigned to the functionality, to the instrumental approach to knowledge. And the Rav is very proud of that. He speaks in glowing and very beautiful terms about all these advancements, and he actually assigns intrinsic significance to technological advancements. And the way he talks about medical research and advancement is absolutely beautiful.
He talks about like taking a flight.
Right, and that's dignity, right? So that's dignified man. And so he's, and it nonetheless is beautifully, as he speaks about the achievements and religious stature and significance of Adam 1, he says, he diagnoses our society, basically, and says 50 years ago at least that we're very instrumental kind of people, and we don't necessarily value sufficiently some of those introspective and deeper dimensions of what it means to be a human being, and there's something really lacking. And then the Rav goes further and he says that's true not only, he says that's certainly true of secular, technological minded Western civilization, but then he says that's also true of religious Western institutions. He says when people go to synagogue, they talk about why they go, or there's sort of the motivation, he says, is very often for social reasons, right? Social, right? It's some of the external benefits, but the notion of prayer, the notion of standing before God, the notion of a deep, authentic religious experience that Rav suggests is one that is sort of very distant. Now,
that's not
I think it's that's part of it, I think, 100%. And I think that there's interesting thing about how there's maybe some pushback against that now in the last, I don't know, 20 years or however long it's been. In Israel, in interesting ways also, by the way. It's here as well, differently. So it would be interesting to sort of, I don't know what the Rav would say about some of, you know, some of them he would probably call fags, you know, whether it's the Kabbalah, the sort of the popular Kabbalah, or the yoga, you know, and, you know, those kind of things. I don't think the Rav would have been big fans of these things. But it is interesting to think about how, you know, is there a sort of a self-awareness about this limitation? So that's sort of that's really interesting. But what the Rav is really driving at, I think if we take a step back, is it's really this dichotomy in a different way. If we sort of situate this in context of this question about the origins of man, I think that's really, the Rav is really grappling with this. Here it's not about animal kingdom versus non-animal kingdom, but what it is about, I think, is very much about these sort of two statuses or two statures of man. Are we lording over the world around us? Is it Adam 1, who is technologically driven and masters the scientific disciplines to the point that he is able to build worlds and to conquer and to achieve and to overcome, whether it's, think about the miracles of, you know, of fertility or whatever it may be, some of the things that we're seeing out there in the world, that really speaks to the majesty of man. That's majestic man in a way. And yet at the same time, the speck of dust and the smallness of man. So I think the lowly man of faith is really part, needs to be seen as part of the Rav's larger attempt to map these two aspects of mankind. And for the Rav, really, there's no synthesis. So it was very interesting for the Rav's thought. The Rav is opposed to other thinkers who believe that there can be a thesis, an antithesis, but then ultimately a synthesis. Hegel, one of the famous historians of 18th, 19th century German thought, becomes very influential, says that all of history unfolds this way. This becomes sort of, ultimately, it folds into a basis for Marxist theory and things like that. But sort of didn't have to go in that direction specifically. It's a broader notion, but that there's one evolution in history, and then there's a countercultural evolution, then there's some sort of grand synthesis, and then the process begins again. Rav Kook thought that way also about modern Israel and a lot of our national destiny. The Rav thought about there's a stress on malchut, on political leadership, and that goes too far, and so there's the Navi, there's the prophet, the religious leader, and then they clash, and then there's some sort of grand synthesis, and so on and so forth. And that's how Jewish history also, according to Rav Kook, unfolds. The Rav says nonsense. He says there is no, and this is a hard truth according to the Rav, but ultimately religion is not about the ultimate sort of easy resolution of these tensions. It's about holding them both, and that's okay. doesn't mean we're supposed to be unhappy through them, but what it does mean is that there isn't some further of, there isn't necessarily some grand synthesis between Adam 1 and Adam 2. It's that there is a tension, there are different aspects of our personality that sort of pull at one another, and our life is going to be constant. The goal of religion is to uplift both of those and to give religious, assign religious significance to both, and for us to make sure that there's, if not a synthesis, a healthy balance at least between them, that if we're too Adam 1 driven, then maybe we need to cultivate another aspect of ourselves. And if we're not actually functioning in a meaningful way out there in the world and producing and able to live an integrated life with the world out there, or to produce, so then we need to pull back toward Adam 1. But ultimately, these two do live in tension. And the Rav says that's okay. Religion doesn't come to make everything comfortable or easy, but it's meant to challenge us and to give religious significance to these and to motivate us to live out these two aspects of our humanity, the greatness and then the smallness, however you want to put it, to really elevate them and to bring religious significance to them. So that's sort of how the Rav sees all this and plays all this out. I see that we didn't quite get through everything, so maybe we'll give this one more, a popular request of one person at least. There are a couple of more things. In terms of schedule moving forward, so just... what?
Well, down the road.
Well, so next week is Wednesday night, is first night of Rosh Hashanah. So we will be off. I'm
Tuesday.
Still what?
We
do Tuesday. I'm not sure I'm able to do it. I'll let you know by email. Most of you I have on the list. A couple of you I don't have. So I guess those who are new, if you could jot down your email for me, that would be great. Make sure to put you on the class list. The week after that, we're having just turn this off, guys.